Hi, I'm Gary from Stonyfield, the organic yogurt company. Do you know what that certified organic label on your food really means? Learn all about that label and why organic is worth it at stonyfield.com. We're proud to be making organic yogurt and honored to support living on Earth, and hope you will too. Donate at loe.org.
Half the world's population lives in cities, and by 2050, it's predicted that 70% of us will be urban dwellers. But cities aren't new. In fact, they're ancient. Music from Mesopotamia. It's here, in the cradle of civilization, that urban societies first emerged 6,000 years ago. Mesopotamia, the land between two rivers, the Euphrates and the Tigris, stretches from what is modern-day southern Turkey through northern Syria and Iraq. Archaeologists aren't sure why cities first formed or how many there were, but thanks to a new technique developed by Harvard professor Jason Ehr and his colleague Bjorn Mentz from MIT, scientists now have a much faster way to identify the telltale signs of ancient urban societies. Jason Ehr says, now in addition to archaeologists putting muddy boots on the ground, they can scan satellite images from space.
I spent 2 months walking around 125 square kilometers of an area around a Bronze Age city in northeastern Syria, and I found 60 sites.
And using your new technique, your satellite technique, how many did you find?
Well, we found 14,000 places of potential interest, which we could narrow down to around 9,500 relatively reliable places. And this was done on computers overnight.
Now, satellite imagery has been around for a long time. So what do you bring that's new to this endeavor?
Well, the traditional way is to get out and start walking. We look for surface manifestations of places where people might have lived, and usually this is in the form of broken pottery. They survive very well, and they end up on the surface. So we could find places of concentrations of broken artifacts.
Slow method.
Very slow. Today, we have systematized this. We are training computers to do this for us. They are much more objective than we are. And then this computer algorithm that I've developed with my colleague Bjorn Mentz at MIT, his algorithm then looks at doing this in an automated fashion, letting computers do our job for us.
Well, let's look. You've brought some images on your laptop. What is this picture here? It looks like an abstract piece of art, black and white and red.
What you're seeing here as red represents the near-infrared band of the visible spectrum, not something that our eyes can normally see. That's one of the real powerful aspects of what we've attempted to do here, is that we can see well beyond what the human eye can see into the near-infrared and infrared wavelengths of light, which are much too large for our own eyes.
So this one looks like almost like an amoeba, an orange amoeba.
Well, here we're looking at a major early city called Tel Brak. I've argued that this is one of the world's first cities, if not the world's first city. It's in, today in northeastern Syria. The amoeba that you're seeing is the areas of high probability of ancient settlement. And what we're really seeing here is we're seeing soils that have been changed by human occupation. I find this particular image of this particular place to be especially compelling because a second image that I can show you here represents the density of surface artifacts, which I collected over the course of 4 seasons of walking back and forth across this place, and they match precisely.
So the idea is here, you take your empirical studies from on the ground, what you found, and then you say, okay, satellite, let an algorithm look at this image, remember this image, and compare that to these other new images and see if there's evidence of an urban settlement.
That's exactly the process. So if I give it a good set of places that I'm 100% certain are ancient places, this algorithm can then develop a very precise understanding of what are the wavelengths that represent an ancient place. In this case, the soils that human activity produced. That's really what it's seeing. And then it can then go find that in other places.
Tell me about Tel Brak. What kind of place was it? And besides just a pile of mud brick at this point.
In the past, it was a thriving, very early city. But what our method has shown is there were outlying neighborhoods around them that were spatially separate. They were not up against each other, such as we think of when we think of urban neighborhoods. But what we find is with time, they grow together. And this is very interesting. Why initially were there distance between these different parts of the settlement, and what overcame this potential reluctance for these groups to come together through time?
What do you think?
This is the great question. What I suspect is that there was an initial pull to bring people into a place like Tel Brak, that we don't quite understand, but I would say that it probably wasn't top down. It was probably something that brought people in under their own volition rather than a central king or ruler compelling people to come in. If I had to guess, I would guess that through time, various institutions developed that could allow people to be more closer together. You know, maybe these were religious institutions, maybe these were political institutions. You know, that's something that requires more than satellites.
These people, tell me a little bit about the people that might have lived in these ancient cities.
The majority of people living in early cities were farmers and herders. They were concerned with very basic elements of sustaining themselves. When we think of cities today, these cities are the homes of the elite, the political elite, great corporations. Cities are homes of consumers, and producers live out on farms elsewhere. The earliest cities were almost certainly the homes of the producers as well.
What does tel mean?
This is a word in Arabic and Hebrew that refers to a ruin. And we don't think of archaeological sites as being up. We think of them as down. You have to dig to get into them. But in fact, in the Middle East, archaeological sites stand out. And this is because people build their houses using mud brick. And mud brick houses don't last very long. After about 50 years, you can no longer patch it up. You need to knock it down and start over. So you level your old house, you build your new house on top of it, and through time, your settlement goes up and up.
So these societies literally built on top of themselves and their predecessors or their ancestors.
This is particularly interesting because people in the past chose to continuously reoccupy exactly the same place. And this doesn't necessarily make sense, because as you go higher and higher, you're getting yourself further and further from things like your fields and, most critically, from water. And this is what's interesting. Why did some of these places become so important that people would continue to live there even though they were putting themselves at a disadvantage in doing so?
Got a hypothesis?
Well, we know that cities were the homes of gods. We think that probably it could have been a cosmological reason, or it could have been political power. In this case, we really have to do excavation rather than just looking at satellites to answer questions like this.
Did you find any cuneiform evidence, written evidence, since these people were the first people to basically use written language, I suppose?
Yes, in this region, we have the origins of writing, and it's very closely associated with the state and early kingship. However, writing postdates the earliest cities. So clearly, urbanism as a phenomenon was something that didn't require this sort of administration or bookkeeping, and probably this is a result of urbanism and not a cause of it.
So urbanization is a very natural process, a very human process. You know, people left upon their own devices will come together?
That seems to be what I take from this particular Mesopotamian case study. I think in a lot of cases, we have a tendency to see governments as behind a lot of these processes, especially in the past. We see things like the famous mythical King Gilgamesh, who claims to have built the great early city of Uruk. He brought this about through his own kind of charisma and political will. Probably this is a later understanding of how these places came about. And in fact, it was probably more of what we would call an emergent phenomenon, people acting under their own motivations, but the aggregate of these actions results in something that might look very planned. And here I see a lot of parallels with the kind of intelligent design movement, where large, complex things can only be the result of some central planner. It certainly isn't the case with ancient cities.
What's interesting to me is that these urban centers existed for thousands of years, and then they're gone, most of them. What happened? Mm-hmm.
Well, there's no single answer. There has been a big attempt in recent years to attribute this to climatic change. This is something, obviously, that we're all very concerned about today, and we think about this in the past. It may be that in some cases, some of these early cities simply overextended themselves. Places got simply too large for the existing agricultural technologies. And sometimes when these are excavated, we find that they have been burned. Archaeologists love burned cities because cities that were destroyed, there's a lot to find there.
People. So probably war?
In some cases. The past was a violent place. There's certainly the 20th century AD does not have a monopoly on violence. That's certainly the case.
What now for you? What do you do with all this information, this data, your algorithm?
Well, obviously it's of academic interest, but there are other aspects of this. We can take this incredible map of settlement, and we can take this to antiquities officials, in this case in Syria, and we can say, here's what you have that you might want to protect. This is the past of of the Syrian people, but it's also the world's past. And this needs to be protected.
In the current fighting that's going on, the war that's in Syria, are you afraid that some of these areas will be destroyed?
Well, this is always a concern. How the past falls victim to modern political activities. A larger concern in the case of Syria right now are the museums. You know, we all saw what happened in Baghdad in 2003. Will this happen again? I hope that lessons will have been learned. But this is something to bear in all places that have become politically destabilized.
Before you go, Professor Ur, I've got to ask you about your name. Ur, it's the ancient city of Ur. That was part of this area we're talking about, Mesopotamia, right?
Certainly, yes.
So?
Well, I've been accused of having a stage name. but in fact, this is a perfectly good Hungarian name. How I ended up as a Mesopotamian archaeologist with this name could be subconscious, I would guess. But I was very close to becoming a Mayanist, which would have meant that this name would have been meaningless.
Well, Professor Ur, thank you for coming in.
No, Bruce, it was my pleasure.
Jason Ur teaches urban archaeology at Harvard University. On the next Living on Earth, too much of a very good thing on the farm has doctors very worried.
Antibiotics are wonderful things. It is frustrating. It is a little bit scary to watch the gradual increase in problems with resistance.
Reining in the use of antibiotics in agriculture, next time on Living on Earth. Living on Earth is produced by the World Media Foundation. Our crew includes Eileen Balinski, Jessica Lees-Kern, Helen Palmer, and Ike Srikandarajan, with help from Sarah Calkins, Patrick Kabanda, Megan Miner, Gabriella Romano, and Sammy Susan. Our interns are Mary Bates and Sophie Golden. Jeff Turton is our technical director. Allison Lurish-Dean composed our themes. You can find us anytime at loe.org, and while you're online, check out our sister program, Planet Harmony. Planet Harmony welcomes all and pays special attention to stories affecting communities of color. Log on and join the discussion at myplanetharmony.com. And don't forget our Facebook page. It's PRI's Living on Earth. And you can follow us on Twitter at Living on Earth. That's just one word. Steve Kerwood is our executive producer. I'm Bruce Gellerman. Thanks for listening.
Funding for Living on Earth comes from the National Science Foundation, supporting coverage of emerging science. And Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt and smoothies. Stonyfield invites you to just eat organic for a day. Details at justeatorganic.com. Support also comes from you, our listeners, the Go Forward Fund, and Pax World Mutual and Exchange Traded Funds, integrating environmental, social, and governance factors into investment analysis and decision making. On the web at paxworld.com. Pax World, for tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.